It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning October 6, 2023. I'm here not to bring you up-to-the-minute news, but to try and ensure news coverage stays up to scratch, up to standard. This past media week has been one, no surprise here, that's been dominated by politics. A shot was fired that ricocheted down the centuries. That's journalese for something that's unprecedented. And when I say politics, I mean, of course, straightforward party politics. You might say traditional party politics, Democrats versus Republicans, as usual. Except that party politics are nowadays definitely untraditional, certainly on the right-hand end of the spectrum. There's hardly anything about today's Republican Party that resembles the GOP of the previous generation. Grand old party. What a cozy-sounding journalistic label that now sounds. And it has next to nothing in keeping with the Republican Party of two generations ago. And now this week we see the ejection of the Speaker of the House, something unprecedented with any party in power over 234 years of Congress. Last week's The Media Beat ended on a note of uncertainty. Would we not, have a shutdown? Since then, headlines everywhere, of course, were emphasizing how the embattled Speaker, now ex-Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, was putting his job on the line, and eventually he lost it, of course, by daring to be bipartisan. Well, just a bit bipartisan, and untypically so. He combined with Democrats across the aisle to keep the lights on in government buildings, continue to pay our soldiers their wages, continue to pay food assistance for poor women and infant children, and continue to extend small business administration loans. So the government didn't shut down overall, or even just in part. It was yet another example of close courting with disaster that various administrations have gone through repeatedly since, oh, I don't know, at least 1980. I remember in that year working still in London and reading the airmail edition of the Washington Post. How about that? No World Wide Web then, of course. I learned with some incredulity that Ronald Reagan was readying his cabinet for a shutdown. I still recall the Post pointing out that it was nothing new. I wrote down at the time a point the Post's White House correspondent was reporting. At least half a dozen times since 1952, she wrote, Congress has moved to make government agencies technically broke. So this week, first came Speaker McCarthy's brazen piece of shutdown avoidance, which was judged to be a case of apparently impermissible compromise with the Democrats. That's at least in the minds of the little band of hard-right extremists who nowadays are seen to be wagging the whole dog of the Republican Party. So then they immediately started gunning for the Speaker, to get him thrown out, no less. They were led by the Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, of whom I'd better say little for the moment. It's been one of those times when straight-faced political reporting finds it hard to portray such exaggerated theatre of the absurd as was unfolding in Congress. As a consumer, I've had to turn from regular journalism to satire in the form of the Borowitz Report, written by the great Andy Borowitz for The New Yorker magazine. He's a good friend to Robin Hood Radio, living in Connecticut as he does, and something of a hero to the Media Beat, I have to admit. I really appreciate the way that Borowitz mimics so accurately the language and tone of our more serious-minded news organizations, right down to the slight shifts in vocabulary without exact repetition to achieve journalistic emphasis. Here's my choice quote of the week. Washington, the Borowitz Report, in a sign of the worsening feud among congressional Republicans, Representative Matt Gaetz lashed out at Kevin McCarthy, accusing the Speaker of, quote, behaving like an adult. Listening to others and striking a compromise are examples of adulthood at its worst, he charged. Kevin McCarthy needs to look at himself in the mirror and ask if he wants to be an adult or a Republican. Andy B. also took the irresistible opportunity, I suppose, to play mercilessly on Representative Gates and his alignment with children. I won't repeat that part of the satire, since I, less so than Andy, it seems, feel a bit constrained by the legal position here. And the legal position is that no criminal charges have been pressed against the representative. I should quote, though, the local newspaper that serves the heart of Gates's district in Florida, the Pensacola News Journal. They decided early this week to run a feature headlined, "Who is Matt Gates?" The paper's local perspectives are instructive. They obviously point out that, to use the paper's own phrasing, Gates finally made good on his threat to trigger a vote to remove Kevin McCarthy. But did you know, for instance, that Matt's father, Don Gates, was a longtime state senator in Florida and is currently considering a return to state politics? The paper also points out, a bit more tellingly, that the House Ethics Committee in Congress has, it says, quietly relaunched an investigation into the Florida congressman, and I quote again, "The focus of the investigation involves allegations of sexual misconduct, campaign finance violations, taking bribes, and using drugs." That reporting has the smack of local accountability for someone sent in all innocence to Washington as the people's representative. So while the national picture unfolds further, the picture of a self-mutilating majority in the more populous of the two chambers in the Capitol, some individual members, Gates to the fore of them, will, I am sure, be coming in for even greater media scrutiny. On the subject of local journalism, I talked last week, perhaps a little over pessimistically, about an epidemic sweeping the nation of closures of regional and local media outlets, and I dwelt a bit on the consequent slumping in ordinary people's civic engagement and the opportunities created in this media vacuum for extremists, whether it's hardliners in the US Congress or Nazis in our neighborhood streets. It's not, though, a totally bleak outlook everywhere we look. There's hope in the air. I should really this week shine a light on some valiant efforts being made to rescue local journalism that's at risk of being wiped off the map. The rescue efforts take various forms. One type of rescue is the growing number of non-profit Samaritans who are stepping in. For example, there is the American Journalism Project in D.C. that describes itself as non-profit, but says that non-profit doesn't mean non-commercial. My longtime colleagues at the PBS NewsHour recently showcased one example of AGP's support. It was Mississippi Today, a digital news source that launched in 2016 and runs primarily on donations and grants. Mary Margaret White is its CEO, and she told the redoubtable Judy Woodruff, who's nowadays happily going out on the road again making special reports, she told Judy that in the last year, Mississippi Today drew in nearly $500,000, and the CEO said she was proud to add that most of that came as small donations from regular folk. AJP and, let's hope, the American Journalism Project gets to trip off our tongue with greater and greater familiarity, is growing fast. Last year it raised $157 million. It supported 41 news organizations, and it launched 4 brand new newsrooms. As evidence, by the way, for its claim that being a non-profit doesn't mean being non-commercial, it can demonstrate that it raises capital from philanthropic sources, of course, but it treats philanthropy as just one pillar in a diversified strategy for raising revenue. All its outlets will variously gain income from advertising, sponsorship, events, as well as paid memberships and subscriptions. Another form of rescue is provided by alliances of local newspapers and websites. One that's been brought to my attention is Courier, a news service that has a very traditional name, but also a very up-to-date outlook and practices. It rather defiantly calls itself a pro-democracy local news network. In fact, the largest pro-democracy local news network in the country, it says. Its network stretches from the Keystone news site in Pennsylvania to the Nevadan in, well, you know where. And of course, being in that state, the website is bilingual, the Nevadan and El Nevadense. One of the guiding principles of all the news sites under the Courier umbrella, and this should be music to our ears, is, and I quote, "We will never use a paywall to gatekeep content." I'm very glad to hear that. Incidentally, a leading figure in Courier's overall editorial ambitions is the rather legendary one-time Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune, Mark Jacob. You could call the Tribune something of a cradle of straight-shooting journalism. I'm a little biased, of course. The Media Beat began its life nearly 20 years ago, when Tribune newspapers commissioned me to write a weekly media column for their New York paper, AM New York. The obvious title for those old-style newsroom men and women was The Media Beat. Beat the media every week, I was urged. Like I said, I'm not totally impartial about Tribune's strain of journalism and therefore about its successor's version of it, but click through and visit Courier.com and you can judge for yourself what their output is like. If we broaden our focus to the world scene, we can see that avoiding a US government shutdown has certainly illuminated the confusion in Republican ranks, and it has done nothing to clarify where the government as a whole stands on the matter of supporting Ukraine. Assisting Ukraine in its effort to repel Russian forces was left out of the bipartisan agreement to keep our government's wheels turning. The administration's wheels, that is. It's the legislature that has its gears well and truly jammed now. And it will take the administration some time and some considerable effort, we should recognize, to reconstitute its Ukrainian aid package and to do so in fuller measure as it might hope. I say this because important indications of change are in the wind about Ukraine policy. It's worth taking a look at the specialist publication Foreign Policy magazine. It carries a report currently that says many officials in both Washington and Kyiv view the American government shutdown saga as a sign, let me quote here, a sign of the United States' fading resolve to support Ukraine's defense against Russia's full-scale and genocidal invasion. Our government leaders, whether they're officials or elected politicians, inevitably pay a lot of attention to opinion polling, whatever they may often say dismissively about polls. And the American public, according to some current surveying, is showing signs of becoming what the late British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher would famously call wobbly. The regular poll commissioned jointly by ABC News and the Washington Post reports that 41% of Americans now say that the US is doing too much to support Ukraine. That's up from only 14% last year when the war was still fairly new. For sympathizers with Ukraine as the decidedly aggrieved party in this grinding conflict, that is very disturbing. Foreign Policy magazine, appropriately enough, asked for comment from a member of Ukraine's National Security Committee, Yehor Cherniev, and he said, "We feel hostage to the internal political struggle in the United States." And perhaps more expressively, Daria Kalenyuk, a political activist in Kyiv, is quoted as saying, "I can tell you what my reaction is, a mixture of betrayal and disappointment." That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.